Our theme this evening is to think about Shema and what exactly we're doing when we say Shema every day. With the framework of, I know when I grew up, I went to public school for a number of years, we said the Pledge of Allegiance every day. And I think part of the question I want to ask is, you know, what are we doing when we say Shema? Is it like a Pledge of Allegiance? Is it not? If not, what is it? So this is kind of meant to be provocative, but also in the sources we're going to see, part of what we're going to look at is how Jewish thought integrates, incorporates some of, you know, the messages, principles of American democracy as we think about authority, theology, etc. Well, I want to explore this idea. We're first going to look at a source that I think the concept it conveys is a little bit more well-known, and then venture into some territory that might expand our perspective a bit. The Talmud says that basically every day when a person says Shema, what they are doing, at least what one particular sage, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Karcha, thinks you're doing, is accepting the yoke of heaven, Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim. And then, right, as you go on and say that second paragraph about reward and punishment, that is about Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, accepting the yoke of the commandments, right? Accepting the reign of heaven, accepting the yoke of the commandments. And in a lot of ways, I think you can look at that framework as an allegiance framework. It literally has the word malchut, right, monarchy, sort of allegiance to the sovereign, and obeying the laws. Right? Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, obeying the laws. So that is one way of thinking about this, and the day-in, day-out ritual, like the Pledge of Allegiance, is essentially a kind of pledge of loyalty. I am in this system, I am still in this system, and it's kind of rigidly, perhaps, defining the boundaries of our commitments, day-in, day-out. However you want to translate that, I think the word yoke is fairly constraining. Now, you could say, Rabbi Eli Confer, who's teaching nearby down the hall, has often taught on Rosh Hashanah and around that time period, that this, even though it may seem kind of rigidly receiving this thing that's the rest of on me, right, this yoke from God, in a world where Jews were generally living under other monarchs and structures of authority, you could actually see this as extremely political. Right? I know who my real God is. I know who the real king is. And you could read this as in defiance of those others who are claiming to have authority, who perhaps don't hold, or I'm sort of refusing to let them have sway over me. So that is one way to read it in a sort of no human kings mode, right? And it's like, O Malchut Shamayim. Okay. But I want to move to some sources that I think get into what some of this initial debate was about, the receiving, accepting, right, how active or passive is this. We're going to look at a set of sources here that say even vis-a-vis God, there is something happening here that is extremely proactive in how we relate to God's power, as opposed to just kind of like bearing the yoke. So we'll run through a couple of lead-up sources, and then our main text is going to be a passage from the Pachad Yitzchak. I'm so sorry, I meant to put his dates here. This is Rav Yitzchak Huttner, a 20th century scholar, sage, who was born in the old country, so to speak, born in Eastern Europe, and made his way to Israel and then to the U.S. and had a yeshiva in Brooklyn for many years, and is known as a kind of integrationist in the different modes of thought that he brings together, both traditional kind of yeshivish ways of thinking, or at least Lithuanian approaches to Jewish learning, and also spent some time at the University of Berlin studying philosophy, though not officially. In any case, he weaves together a lot of different sources in 20th century, so we'll see where he goes. Okay, but first, let's look at these two brief passages, sources 2 and 3 in section 2 here. Shema, proactively crowning God, that's what we're aiming for. And some of this is really rooted in Rosh Hashanah material about God and kingship. So, source number two from Masachat Rosh Hashanah talks about the main kind of themes of Rosh Hashanah, where God says, recite before me on Rosh Hashanah verses that mention kingships, malchiyot, remembrances, zichronot, and shofarot. Kingships, so that you will crown me as king over you. Kadesh atam lichuni aleichem. Okay, that's the part we're going to be interested in. And we're going to wonder, what exactly does it mean to crown God over us? Okay. Hold your thoughts for right now on what you think that might mean. We're going to see the direction Rav Huttner goes. Now, the other thing we need to see here is that the way this works, as you know, from the extremely lengthy Musaf prayer on Rosh Hashanah, is we don't recite one verse for each of these. We recite 10 verses from the Bible for each of these themes. And one debate that you see in the Talmud that actually traces back even earlier is whether or not the verse Shema Yisrael counts as kingship. Okay, so if you think about the whole verse, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad, does it have the word melech for king? It does not have the word for king. But we did just see in that first source we looked at that when we are saying Shema, it is to accept God's kingship. Kadesh Kabel Alav Ol Malchut Shamayim. So it seems like we treat it day in, day out as a verse that's about recognizing God's authority as king. But there's actually a debate in the Talmud we see in Source 3 as to whether or not it counts towards our verses about kingship. Okay, so this is just to build up to this question. What are we doing when we say Shema? What kind of activity is it vis-a-vis God's authority? Okay, so now we're in source number four here on the bottom of page one. And again, we've now jumped to the 20th century. Maybe I'll have somebody read for us. The Talmud records. Any volunteer? Loud, clear. Go ahead, Sylvia.
The Talmud records a Tanaitic dispute as to whether one fulfills one's obligation to recite kingship, malchuyot, and Rosh Hashanah with Shema Yisrael. This merits analysis. Is not Shema Yisrael the very verse through which all of Israel daily discharge the obligation of the acceptance, the yoke of the reign of heaven? How is it possible that this verse cannot serve as kingship on Rosh Hashanah?
Okay, good question. That's what we've sort of set up for ourselves. Okay, I thought this is about kingship, allegiance to God's kingship. Why wouldn't it count towards that theme? Okay, now this is going to become very interesting. Keep going.
The Tanakh teaches.
Me oivai techakmeni. I know it's hard to read in English.
But my enemies make me wise.
Okay, so he often will just like throw in a verse from wherever in Tanakh to sort of say what he's doing. We are going to learn from this principle that appears in Psalms. Make me wise from my enemies. This is an opportunity for him to introduce a source of wisdom or knowledge that you might otherwise think has nothing to teach you about how to relate to God. But as long as you have that preface, I can become wise for my enemies, we can now turn to unexpected sources to learn about our relationship with God.
Sometimes wisdom is gained specifically from the course of the matter for one who hates us. And so it is in this way.
Okay, hopefully you're intrigued. What are we going to look at? What's our enemy? Who we're going to learn from? Okay, great. Thank you so much. New reader here on the top of page two in the laws of idolatry.
In the laws of idolatry, behold that the proclamation, you are my God, made to an idol, is judged as equal to sprinkling or slaughtering or the like acts of worship.
Okay, so when the Talmud is going through, what kinds of things can get you in trouble for idolatry? You might say the opposite of pledging allegiance to God. What kinds of things lead to a significant violation? There's a whole set of actions that are mostly actions of worshiping a different God, but it includes the oral declaration, you are my God.
Our teacher, the Chazon Ish, innovated in this, that one who says, you are my God, is culpable for idolatry only when saying it as a statement of coronation, but not when it is uttered as an acknowledgement of a pre-existing fact.
Okay, thank you. That's a little bit complicated. Chazon Ish, you can see Rav Avraham Yeshayahu Karlitz from the 19th to 20th century, has this distinction. Okay? There are two ways to say you are my God. You can say you are my God as a statement of coronation, meaning that is your words having an effect on reality. Or you can say you are my God in a way that is simply descriptive. It is acknowledging a pre-existing fact. Now I will give this aside. I took German one summer just because I had to for a PhD. So I sort of learned enough to pass an academic test. But the teacher there talked a lot about the range of kinds of speech, right, that have different kind of grammatical forms, right? So there is, and different tenses, right? This is one end of a spectrum, which is speech acts that change reality, right? It's like your example of the wedding. Speech acts that change reality as opposed to speech acts that might merely describe reality. Okay, so the most extreme end of the spectrum would be a magical incantation. That's like very clearly you're saying words that you think could change the reality. And this is perhaps not as supernatural as that, but still the point is this is a speech act that changes reality. If you say it in a way that is meant to make that idol into a deity, that's when you're culpable. Okay, let's keep going a little bit. We'll see if we gain more clarity. In other words, shall I have a new reader? Let's have in the corner. Amichai, go ahead.
In other words, the statement must not be merely a declaration that a situation continues to exist, because such a statement simply affirms a known fact in which the one who pronounces it does not participate in its formation. The kind of statement which makes the one who says it liable for idolatry must be a statement of activating its sovereignty. In other words, through this statement, he makes the god into a king, and the statement creates the status of sovereignty for my enemy.
Okay, so this is our analogy. We are going to learn from idolatry. We're now going to jump back to our question, which is about Shema and how we relate to God and God's sovereignty. Okay, so this is the surprising move he's making. You want to know how our relationship with God works? It's almost anthropological here, right? Not quite, but I think it's maybe inspired a little bit by anthropology, right? Let's look at how one relates to other gods. And from that, learn about the Shema and God. Okay, so where is he going with this? I'm going to read this next part. Herein, okay? Herein we find the distinction between the acceptance of the yoke of the reign of heaven throughout the year, meaning when we say Shema, day in, day out, versus the statement of kingship on Rosh Hashanah. In our daily acceptance of the yoke of the reign of heaven, our task is not at all to emphasize the activation of the creation of sovereignty. We're not activating God's sovereignty. We accept upon ourselves the yoke of sovereignty, which existed continuously even before our acceptance. Okay? So, God is God, and day in, day out, we are in a way kind of pledging allegiance to that already existing God. The statement of kingship of Rosh Hashanah is totally different, because the essence of the kingship of Rosh Hashanah is specifically the act of coronation. This is a speech act that is making God king. It's changing reality, so to speak. The kingship verses of Rosh Hashanah are the crowning of the sovereign. They renew God's sovereignty or monarchy. Okay, this is a sort of radical statement, though he's about to bring verses that I think suggest it's not as radical as you might think. Right, but the idea is there's some kind of human agency involved in making God have the power God has, in making God king. Right? It's not exactly an election. It's not exactly a democratic election, but it does give a certain kind of power to our activity. Okay, and now he's going to bring a passage from earlier sources. It's from the Sifrei, so Tanaitic sources, like back in the early stages of the Talmud, this goes way back, that God is contingent on us making God God, or treating God as God. Okay, so someone to read for us in this vein. Yeah.
In this vein, the sages said the verse, and he became a king in Yeshun when the chiefs of the people gathered from Devarim. When is God called the king? When Israel accepts God upon themselves? If not, as it were, God is not called the king.
Okay, so this is one articulation of God's contingency on human activity, right? Our declaration of God as king is what makes God king. Keep going.
Or as they said in the verse, you are my witness and I am God, Yeshayahu. When am I God? When you are my witnesses. But if you are not my witnesses, I am not God, as it were.
Okay, right. So the idea that God is not just God, but actually requires us to accept God upon ourselves, witness God, right? There's some kind of agency that we have to make God God. This is the idea of a proactive, right? It's not just allegiance to an already existing God, it's proactively making God God, proactively crowning God. The only other thing I'll say is, like, it could be that this becomes more relevant when there are all sorts of other people in the world worshiping other gods. Like, that's when God needs us as witnesses, so people have some sense of who God is. But maybe before there were any people, this was perhaps less necessary to make God visible, so to speak, or manifest. Okay, right now this is meant to be provocative, okay? So just to get to the closing piece here, and then we're going to have a little bit of a deeper dive on that Chazon Ish. This, then, is the intent of the kingship of Rosh Hashanah. We are not merely saying to the Holy Blessed One, behold, you are the king. It's not just descriptive. Whether we are saying to God, we are crowning you as king, it's the activation of the creation of the monarchy. Okay. So Shema, then, is not exactly allegiance. It's not a kind of rigid allegiance of a pre-existing thing. It's a proactive choice to make God into God. And I just want to take a closer look here at the Chazon Ish, the bottom of the page, that was referenced briefly, because right now what we're imagining is that once a year we do this proactive thing to make God God, and there's some recognition of, like, God's power isn't totally unilateral and supreme, but is deeply tied to human agency, right? That's the piece that I think may be stemming in part from democratic notions of how authority works, right, in the 20th century. But otherwise, day in, day out, we are sort of pledging allegiance to that God that we renewed back in September. And I kind of want to push this a little bit further. Let's look at the Chazon Ish. At the bottom of the page, it says, the category of accepting a foreign god is only prior to worship, right? This is that statement, you are my god. That only counts as idolatry if you haven't yet worshipped that god. For then when a person says, you are my god, the meaning is that one is assenting from this moment to its existence and power so as to worship it. This is the worship for which one is culpable. But if you've already worshipped or not done teshuva for previously worshiping this idol, then you're already in that prior status, this relates to your point, where it doesn't have the meaning of accepting from this moment on, but rather indication that one may worship it at some point. The verse from which this is derived goes in this direction as well, that it's the moment of assenting to this God. It's based on the verse in Exodus from the golden calf, Eile Elohecha Yisrael, right? This is your God. To create something new, to assent to the golden calf. Right? That's when they got in trouble for those words. And my question is, I think that in some ways we don't have a full analogy here, or I want to play with this analogy. Okay, we're saying when it comes to an idol, once you have said the words, you are my God, the first time, That's a problem. From then on out, you're not really doing that much. But I want to suggest that might be because by nature, an idol is static. That's what Avodah Zarah is. It's worshiping a static, finite object. But then if you think about it when it comes to God, like the real God, Hashem, like, first of all, why do we have to renew God's kingship annually? Right? Doesn't that suggest that something might be changing in our conception of God that requires us to newly accept God as God? Right? And in some ways, I would say, like, that is the difference, a major difference, between God, Hashem, and all these idols, which is that God is actually not finite, but infinite. And to sort of bring in a perspective on Maimonides here, we can never think that we totally know God fully. In fact, we can only hope to spend every day of our lives understanding better how we don't know God. Whoever we thought we were worshiping as God yesterday, the best we can hope for in our lives is that by the time I get to today, I understand better that what I thought God was yesterday was wrong in some way. Right? I'm trying to arrive at a fuller understanding of who God is day in, day out in my life. Right? And because of that, I would maybe even go so far to say that actually Shema Yisrael day in, day out, right, represents an extremely dynamic relationship with God. It's not just allegiance in a kind of rigid way to that same God I think I've always known and the rigid laws that are mitzvot. It represents day in, day out that I have a new understanding, a more refined understanding of who God is, of what God demands of me, and by definition, what it means to be in relationship with Hashem, as opposed to idols, is that that is going to be a dynamic process that will unfold over the course of my lifetime. Okay, so I offer this to you, and I'm happy for a couple of comments and questions as we close, that instead of thinking of Shema as this kind of rigid allegiance of the same commitment over and over, the gift that we have of being in relationship with God as our sovereign and source of authority is that we are invited into a relationship that is meant to be dynamic. And we have the opportunity to name how dynamic it is when we say Shema and again say, right, you are my God, but I now understand what that means differently each day.